Bis zum 7. Mai kannst du dich noch zum Female Leadership Programm anmelden. Im Juni geht es los. Sprich jetzt mit deinem Arbeitgeber oder buche als Privatzahlerin zu stark vergünstigten Konditionen auf female-leadership-academy.de.
There are no such things as the 5 golden bullet points for everyone in the world. You have to think yourself. That's what you paid for as a leader. To think and rethink and to see what it takes in your company.
Herzlich willkommen zum Female Leadership Podcast. Mein Name ist Vera Strauch und ich bin Host hier im Podcast, in dem es darum geht, dass du deinen ganz eigenen Stil im Job und Leben findest und deinen Weg mutig und selbstbewusst gehst. In dieser Folge geht es um Kulturentwicklung und darum, wie wir in Organisationen Kulturen gestalten, welche Rolle Führung dabei spielt und was wir gerade auch für große Transformationen mitnehmen können. Dazu habe ich mit der Anthropologin Jitzke Kramer gesprochen, die zu Kulturen und Kulturentwicklung forscht. Und sie hat erzählt, was Kultur bedeutet und wie Kultur funktioniert, wie Gemeinschaften sich organisieren und was sich mitnehmen lässt für den Organisationskontext aus den Antworten ganz unterschiedlicher Gemeinschaften auf Fragen wie, wie funktioniert eigentlich gutes Zusammenleben? Was braucht gute Führung? Und auch, wie gehen wir mit großen Herausforderungen in Gemeinschaft um? Diesen Fragen ist Jitzke nachgegangen und hat sich umgesehen, wie sehr unterschiedlich Gemeinschaft darauf reagiert und wie dann Gemeinschaft sich formt und auch vor allem verändert. Und dann sind wir sehr konkret geworden im Gespräch, was das bedeutet für Führung, für starke Kultur und was wir grundsätzlich aus der Anthropologie für das Miteinander in Organisationen lernen können. Es ist ein wirklich richtig facettenreiches, vielseitiges und wie ich finde sehr inspirierendes und lehrreiches Gespräch geworden. Ich freue mich sehr, es mit dir zu teilen. Kurzer Hinweis noch, es ist in englischer Sprache, weil Jitzke Niederländerin ist, lässt sich aber wirklich sehr gut verstehen und deswegen lohnt es sich, auch wenn du vielleicht nicht so viel im Englischen unterwegs bist, dran zu bleiben und reinzuhören. Und in diesem Sinne legen wir gleich mal los. Jitzke, welcome to the podcast. I'm so happy to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're an anthropologist. And my opening question is, what do anthropologists do?
The field of study is that we try to understand, at least cultural anthropology tries to understand how people shape cultures and cultures shape people. And what I do, I try to understand that process and translate that into the business world. And therefore, I sometimes call myself a corporate anthropologist because I try to understand how people shape cultures in organizations and what the impact is if we want to change them.
That's the perfect topic for us to talk about. Maybe before we dive in, is there anything in particular that you're working on right now, something that you're interested in and where your mind is at?
Yeah, from December onwards, I'll do not so many talks as I usually do, and I'll take a couple of months to study, to do field work, basically, to the world we live in now, which is full of transitions, transformations, crises, and all that. Anthropologists call those times liminal times, betwixt and between, the time where you know or sense that what was no longer is, and that you got to find out where to go. And in that times, we need certain leadership. I do already have some knowledge around that, but I want to understand what's going on in society now from the anthropological point of view. And then, I don't know, maybe I might write a book or get some other thing out, but it will be around these liminal times and how we can deal with that. So that's on my mind.
Okay. And how long is this period going? How long do you set an end or is it just open?
Well, I'll take about 9 months. So till the end of August. And I'll do some talks and some other stuff. I run a company, so I still do other things. But I really want to take the time to zoom out and to see the patterns which are there, because there's always ad hoc and there's things going on. But it's also nice to try to understand what's really going on and write about that. So that's the thing I'll do in a couple of weeks' time.
And how do you do that? Where do you get your data from? Like what do you do? You just sit and watch or you travel?
Well, first I've got a whole lot of books which I collected, which are anthropological research books. So I'll dive into paper knowledge, talk with a lot of people. So I will talk with leaders what to do in crisis and what they experience. I might travel to Africa. There's a moment where different tribal leaders will get together to solve an issue around wildlife, which is a different type of crisis, but it's a crisis. So I'm curious how they deal with it and what we can learn from different places. I might go to the military and see how people deal with crisis and things in that area. So things are open. And for an anthropologist, it's, at least for me, it's like trying to find the right question to ask. So that will be the first step in my research. What is the true question I have? And doing that, I'll read, I'll talk, I go about, and then find places where to find answers. So it's very open. And I'm at this moment, I don't want to close it too quick and just see what will pop up once I do it and once I start talking. And I notice already that, you know, on LinkedIn and on other places, people who know my work and know about my ideas, they come up and they say, well, if you think about that, you should look at this or you should read that. So in anthropology, we tend to call it the snowball method, that you start somewhere and you go from person to person and see what's there and what kind of story will unfold.
Sounds so wonderful. Or you're looking forward to that, or is it?
Oh, yes, very much. Yeah.
Yeah. One question regarding reading. Do you have a method or a structure how to go through the books that you collected?
Well, first of all, I read it. So that's one. And I need to read it with a pen. Otherwise, I can't remember it. So I really study a book. And after I did that, then I summarize it again, like a piece of paper and a pen to really get the main thing of that. And then sometimes I decide to put bits and pieces in my talks. So then I put it into slides. And in that whole process, the theories and the thoughts really download in my mind. And in the meantime, I get ideas. So I write them on a different notebook. And those are new ideas and new things where I see new patterns and where I can connect the dots in a different way or do some more research, look at the notes in the book and the references and see if there's different traces I need to follow up on because I'm interested in that. So that's really desk research.
And how did you get to where you're now? How did the topic or the field of anthropology come to your radar? How did you design? It sounds like a super, like a life I would like as well. How did you get there?
Thank you. Well, I started off by getting training to go to theater school, to acting school. So that was when I was 16, 18. I was very serious about that. And I was just curious, why do people do the things they do? Why don't they do it differently? And when you're acting, that's what you learn. But then I came across anthropology, just universal study, academic field. And it was basically saying the same thing, but then from an academic point of view in terms of doing research and trying to understand those different cultures and really looking into the space between people. So I got intrigued that if you look at a group and you take all individuals out and there's all new people, so there's refreshments, then still the culture kind of sticks. It's a very mysterious phenomenon in a way that if you think about that. So I got intrigued in that. So that's why I decided to study anthropology. And went to university and did the research and went to Uganda and Botswana to do research, specialized as a theater anthropologist. So that did get back to that. And as theater anthropology, in my studies, I studied theater for development, which is really meaning what is the role and the importance of theater in society, because there's a function to it, because there's no group of people in the world who don't have music. So music is a universal thing. Dancing is a universal thing. People create stories. It's a universal thing. They tell each other stories. So why do people do that? Why is that so important? And when you look at that and you use the power of those theaters, acting and tour storytelling, you're pretty much in the field of training and development in a way. So from my studies in Uganda, I got involved here in the Netherlands with training courses you know, it sounds like a big leap, but in a way, it's very close. So I entered organizations, and it was kind of harder. The culture shock in an organization to me was larger than to a village in Uganda, because people do really funny stuff in organizations, and it's really hard to get in. There's codes, and you cannot just walk in an organization. You can walk into a village, but not into an organization. So, and there's rituals, and there's language, and if you don't talk like that, you're out. So I got intrigued with what do people do in organizations, and I sticked around for years. So that's why I started to study people living in corporate tribes, so to speak, in organizations, and work in the field of training, coaching, consulting, doing all that. So I got involved with global leadership, international teamwork, but also culture change programs. And I noticed that many people work on organizational culture and change, but hardly anyone is an anthropologist or knows about how people shape cultures. So to me, it's sad. And I get annoyed also and frustrated that such an important topic, if we think about change and transformation and including the new technologies into organizations, that culture is such a, it's like the core of things. That's what people say, you know, it's all about people in the end. Yeah. And it's acceptance and trying on new stuff and leadership and communication and feedback and all that. That's what anthropologists call culture, the norms and the values. And also how we divide things and how we organize financial streams and all that. So I got really intrigued by that and started writing and starting my own company and get people and train people, and decided to do more research, not only on organizations, but especially around the world, where you see that the questions we have in organizations, they're the same because we're people, like how to deal with leadership, what to do with change, how to deal with time, how to be effective, sustainability, all these topics, inclusion, they're universal. So I like to travel the world to understand how that works and then bring that back to organizations. So, and for me, that kind of closes the circle that I'm, you know, more and more on stage. And that's where I can, you know, use the things I learned when I was 18, when I went to acting classes, and integrate that in my work now. And doing the research as an anthropologist, so going back into the field.
Oh, I have so many questions. Let's just go to culture first. So what you were describing, I think, fits pretty much what people who are listening here, I think I, for myself speaking, definitely are struggling with, because we try to change and we have to change things. I mean, it's obvious, so... And there's this resistance against necessary change. And I'm so interested in, and so I'm super interested in, how do cultures work? Are there maybe some major things that you'd identify that, especially from a standpoint of transformation, critical to know and to have in mind?
Yeah, I think to me, the core processes of culture shaping are interaction and decision making. So you could say that we can go from the assumption that nothing has meaning of itself, and that's a big statement if you think about that. So every behavior just is, but we cannot live with that. We have to decide what we think is a good idea when it comes to leadership. Is it autocratic? Is it more democratic? How do we deal with the differences between men and women? So you have universal issues or questions or themes where there's no universal answer to it. It's not, cultures don't fall from the sky. We create them. And that's because when we get together, we got all these questions. Okay, time is ticking. How do we deal with time? How do we create our reciprocity systems? I give you something, you give me something back. You put it in a contract. Do we keep the contract? Do we change it? So you could say that basically nothing has meaning of itself. All types of behaviors and issues just are, but a group of people, regardless where they are, they need to find answers to those questions. And those answers, you could say, are culture. So cultures, I like to say, are unique answers to universal questions. Now, how do we get to those answers? We have to talk. So we interact. So groups of people get together and then they interact. They say, we like this, we don't like that. You know, it's like that. We don't do those designs usually, you know, on a flip chart. Most families don't have a flip chart in a room saying, okay, so what's our culture? And what's our family core values? That's what we only do in organizations. But for the rest in the world, we just happens. So we kind of decide, we think this is valuable and this is not, and this is right behavior, this is wrong, and this is beautiful, and this is ugly, and this is true, and this is false. So cultures give the frame of how things work, and we get there through interaction. Now the question is, who can join which interaction? So, and that's a diversity issue, that's a power issue. So if we have to decide how to deal with the world, with the nature, who can join the conversation where we spend the money on, you know? So that's the interaction process. And then the next question is, who will decide? So to bring it, make it very small and close to home, is if you go on a holiday with your family, who can join the interaction process? So I have the kids, do they have a say or not? And does it depend on their age or not? And are they, you know, part of the decision-making process? Or do you say, no, we as parents decide for you, or can they vote? So it's really who can shape the world, because if nothing is meaning of itself, we create what is important and what is not. And once we have that kind of storyline, we start shaping the world, literally buying stuff, creating stuff, building buildings, getting system into place. So the ones who are able to make decisions where to spend money on, they have what I call definition power. They can define the world. Now, if you can define the world, that's great, because you can decide that this is good and bad. And usually decide that the things which you consider good are the things you are able to do, or are the things that you believe in, or how you look. So you can create the world, define the world in your own views and perspectives, and what you think is important. Now, if there's change, that is all challenged. So change means that you're challenged on your basic assumptions. That's for one, what you think is beautiful. So it used to be beautiful to go on city trips, maybe every week if you had the money and the time. Now it's not that beautiful. We think it's pretty ugly to do so because of the world and the shape we're in. So it changes. So that means that you've got to change your behaviors. You've got to change your views, your talk, and the way you talk about it and how you define the world. So, and that's painful, because you have to rethink the things you do. You may have to live a different storyline. You have to change your behaviors. And if we get to it in larger transformations, then we decide together as a small family or a huge company or society where we spend money on. And if we change it and we say, well, the car used to be, you know, the big thing, everyone needs to have a car, so that's very good for the car industry and petrol and all that. And if we shift that and we say, we think that's a pretty ugly thing to do, so let's do more the sharing business, so we'll buy less cars. So the car industry won't be very happy with that, and we use less petrol. So there's different financial power structures going on. So huge changes change our value systems, our storylines, our behaviors, and how the world is shaped, and therefore it changes power structures. And that's where it's tough.
If we look at an organization, yeah, and we look at the culture, and you were talking earlier, I think you were this example of one person is leaving and the culture sticks, it stays. Because I also have a company and I'm a founder, yeah, so I find this very interesting. What's the tipping point? What happens? Because if you look at a small group and you have two people, would that already be a group? No, you need three? I don't know. It's just very small.
Well, you can if two is a very small group. Yeah. But still, if you think about it in family life, then you have a boyfriend or girlfriend or a non-binary friend, and you live together. So you use a very small group and you create a culture in your house. So in your house, you have ways of doing stuff, but also how you organize the kitchen, because that's linked to what you think is important and valuable when it comes to cooking. And that's how you create, design, and define your world, you know. Now, let's say you get rid of that one life partner. So you still have your house And you have the ways of doing things, which are like the extension of what you, your behaviors and your patterns. Now, a new person comes in. And obviously, the dynamics will change because it's a very small group. But still, there is a defined world. So you show the other person around in the kitchen. Or do you get rid of everything and say, okay, so now we're together now. Let's create totally new patterns. How shall we organize our lives? What do you think is important? Do we move to a different place? Do we get all the furniture out? So, yeah, a small group, but you bring along your own preferences. But obviously, when it's two people and you change one, the impact will be big. But if it's 100 people and you change one, you'll notice that it's not only the furniture in the house, but it's the behavioral patterns. So it's there's patterns around in every organization how you have meetings. When you are too late or on time, you know, can you be 5 minutes late or 10? When you get in, do you get coffee or tea or champagne? Or, you know, what's the norms? So and once it's there, it kind of sticks into the wall and it hangs in the air. It's just what we call culture. And it's a storyline. So when new people come in, they hear the stories and they notice that if they do it differently and if it's core behaviors, the group will let them know that that's not how we do stuff here. So there is this very strong storyline that you'll get pulled into.
And so if we want to change culture, we have these two elements that you were speaking of, interaction and decision making, as major aspects where to start.
Yeah, so it's interaction, decision making, which shapes and also reshapes. So you have to, and in the changing, I feel it's important to understand that a culture change is a change in, first of all, the collective behavioral patterns. It's not just one person, but the collective behavioral patterns, which is linked to norms and laws. So that's, you know, that's one thing. The other one is linked to collective storylines and narratives. So what we think is important, what we talk about, the language we use and what we feel is right and wrong. It's a storyline. And then the final one is that culture change has everything to do with reshaping the world. So it's going to be, we have to tear down buildings and create new ones, and we have to change structures and financial systems if we believe other things are important. So we redesign the world, and that's another one where it gets tangible in the physical world. So if we decide that different behaviors is valuable, then we need to change our structure when it comes to salary and our bonus systems. You get bonuses and finances for different types of behaviors. So we need to change the competence profiles of leaders, and we need to ask the leaders, well, either you learn the new behavior and you get paid for that, or you move. And that's tough because the leaders are the ones who can define the world. So they might say, well, not such a good idea. So you see that the changing, the vehicle to do that is interaction and decision making. And the question is who can interact with what and decide what. And the topics to think about are the collective behavioral patterns, the collective storylines, and the redesign of the world.
I always come back to the point, okay, who feels responsible for this overall system change if I go bigger and bigger? Because in the subsystems, I feel still hopeful and optimistic because I see organizations, also large organizations, who are really committed to change, yeah, and also aware of the consequences, or at least a major part of it. But then the larger we get on the system level, the less I see people who feel responsible with the power to change. Might be a different topic.
No, yeah, but the thing is that there's two things going on, I think. I like to say that if the heart of power really wants it, it'd be done in 24 hours. So if the heart of power really wants a certain thing to change, it will be done in a very short time. And 24 hours might be a bit short, but still. So then the question is, where is the heart of power? And yes, the heart of power is, you know, in the top of organizations, obviously, since there's hierarchies and decision makers. But majority of people, our numbers, have a lot of power too. And if you have a clear opinion and you know how to write, you have a lot of power, writing power, or you have power of speak, or you have power of knowing people, or you have power of money, or name it, be artistic. So I think there is many sources of power we can tap into, and realizing that each individual has a huge impact. Because if we think about interaction decision making, every time I make a decision, a micro decision, I keep what's there or I change it. And a micro decision, I need to do my groceries in a few hours. So I decide what I buy for this weekend. And by deciding which product I buy and I don't buy, I have an impact on the world. It's just like that. Do I buy my meat or not? What kind of, do I buy milk, cheese? What kind of vegetables do I buy? Is it local or more globally produced? So I have an impact. And if large numbers of people take different decisions than they used to do, it will have an impact. So, I agree with you that it would be very helpful. Well, I don't know if you agree with that. I agree with myself. That would be very helpful if, on a larger scale, in terms of political power, CEOs of huge companies, if they would decide to change things, let's say more sustainable or more inclusive or whatever they want to go to, that will go faster because they have definition power in a way that they define where they decide to spend money on, and that will have a huge impact, way more than me as an individual buying groceries. But it's not an either-or discussion. It's a both-and discussion. And I feel it's important that people don't feel powerless. There's so many ways how we shape the world, and each and everyone has an impact.
I came across this concept. I think it was Brené Brown who shared a concept of, it's a women's collective. They are called Just Associates. So they have a different power definition. Instead of the power over other people, things, a kind of dominance-driven power definition, they define power on three different levels, and one of them is power within. So everyone, every person has power in there. You cannot not have power. And the concept basically is power grows once you share it. And it's not something that you have to take from someone, so you get more of it. But once you share it, you get I really like, because you were talking about narratives, I really like that, because it's a true empowering. It's not the empowering, because empowerment in the definition of dominance means I have to give something away. And once we talk about privileges and, you know, all the fear that is connected to change because I might lose something, it's so deeply rooted in this narrative of I have to give something up if I share my power, if I have to lose something. Whereas if we look at the whole concept differently, it is something that grows. And it's something that we don't have to take from each other, because sometimes I feel like we're so focused on what we, the interactions, and I understand where it's coming from, but then we have these big topics like climate change, and I'm like, okay, climate crisis, sorry. There's so much to do, and I feel like let's focus our energy. We need different narratives so we can move in the right speed. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I agree, and it's like you can have power over people. Mm-hmm. Some people have, and power to get something done, mm-hmm. and each and one have. But I think it would be naive to think that there is not such thing as power over others. Because it is true, there are dictators in the world who can decide to throw bombs. Mm-hmm. So that's still there. And in more micro situation, there are team leaders who decide to suddenly fire someone or to scream and take away your project. So it's power is there. We are hierarchical beings. We are Homo sapiens. Is just we build hierarchies. It's what we do. It's like we can like it or not, but that's what we do. The question is, what do we do with the power we have? So if you have power because of the amount of money you have, or the position you have in organization, or the way you can express yourself and thoughts, or any power source you have, I feel it just comes with responsibilities. So then the question is, do you use that power for your own career and well-being, or do you also take into account the well-being of the group, the tribe, your own organization, the branch, the society, the world at large? You know, where do you define your group? So I can use it just to take care of my family and, you know, the others just see how they deal with it. Or do I take care of my neighborhood? And, you know, where do I see myself part of the world? So power will be there and there will be misuses of power, no doubt. It's just that if you are in a position of power, how will you use that? And if you feel that there is misuse of power somewhere, do you have the strength and the courage to step up to leaders to say, hey, this is not right? And therefore, again, interaction, decision making, can we interact in a way that we can express things we don't like? Or can we deal with disagreement, with conflict? And that's where I think most of us are lacking skills to do so. So we're not so good and dealing with opposing views. While that is a core system of change, it's when we really look at all the different perspectives, which sounds great, like have a brainstorm, look at all the different perspectives and leverage the differences. Oh, sounds really cool. But it basically means deals with conflict and with emotions related to that. And if we are able to do so, I think it's easier to also contain the different ways of power we have over each other and to do stuff.
One question regarding the hierarchy. I wanted to go a different direction, but I just have to just quickly talk about that, because wouldn't you say, I mean, if we look at how we define Homo sapiens and how people, men, are supposedly are, wouldn't you say that this narrative about how we are and how we have to interact, or the manifest rules that there are, aren't they shaped by patriarchy? Because for thousands of years, and all the research and everything we've been doing basically is shaped by that. And if we are clear about that, we want to overcome this, and it's not a good concept that there are men who have power, way more power than others, over men and women and everyone. So this dominance culture, which is so deeply rooted in us, and it hasn't always, it's not that it has always been there, but it has been there since, I don't know how many thousands of years. So is our knowledge and our opinions about who we are as Homo sapiens not deeply shaped by that? And is it truly like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. It is shaped. Of course, it has a huge impact because we cannot escape the storyline we grew up in. So if we think about how we look at history and how we make interpretations of what we did, you can see that the dominant storyline of that moment in time dictates how we make interpretations of who used to be leaders. And yes, since for many years in many places in the world, the dominant view was the definition power, in my words, laid with men, then obviously the storylines of women are less present, and that definitely needs to change. I mean, we got voting rights since 100 years or a bit more, but I think we can do better than that. So yes, there is misinterpretation. The same that we look at continent like Africa as if they didn't have history before white man entered land. So that's like absolutely ridiculous. So there are so many moments that where we say, well, you can divide the world in two genders, there's male and female, but that's a concept which was pushed for a large deal by the church and by religion. Well, if you look at indigenous cultures all across the globe, they have different non-binary systems. So, yeah, like I said, nothing is meaning of itself. We have to create the meaning together. So that's culture. And cultures, we shape them together, but those cultures shape us. So once you grow up, then the people around you shape you and shape your view of the world in what they think is true at that moment. So obviously all the thoughts which are in your mind are shaped by your parents, by everyone who has a say in what I tend to say your pocket money, which we call salary when you grow older. But so that's the vertical power and the horizontal power with all your best friends, and they tell you, you know, what's right and not, what clothes to wear and what not. So yes, on a larger scale, we're hugely impacted by the power structures which have been in place for years. And there is a dominance in religion, and there's a dominance in economic growth, the belief that that's the way, that we need to grow economy every day. And that has been a very valuable system for a while. And now we say, well, maybe we need to change that. And need to change the core values. Like at one point in the world, people believed that slavery was a good economic model. And well, luckily people said, well, that's pretty unvaluable. It's horrendous. So they changed that. But still, we still have child labor, and we still have places in the world where there is slavery. So, you know, it's really changing a storyline, changing what we think is valuable, and then changing behaviors and power structures. While we do that, we live in what we think is true. So we study ourselves, and that's sometimes more complicated, but at least it pushes us to be very, very aware and to challenge our basic assumptions every day to see if what you believe in and your unconscious biases and the things you have, are they still true for now? And do you allow yourself to shift and change your views? And And around masculinity, femininity, that's at least one of the topics we need to talk about.
You were talking about this, I would call it collective competence. Maybe it's not your words, but I feel like that's what I heard. So you said something about conflicts and how we, in my words, it's how we deal with this uncertainty, with people having a different opinion, with just the fact that life has... there are problems in every life and in every culture, in every group, in every family. And it makes a difference how we deal with it. And the way is not to just ignore it or try to push it away. And I'm so curious, how can we support building these competences, this collective learning? Because sometimes for me, this is such a big key. And I'm wondering what it needs to support that, because I feel like we are running out of time and it would be so helpful. It would heal. It would help a lot of pain and also violence. The narrative about violence is another topic. I mean, it's not something that is just tragic and there. It's something that reproduces it itself. And once we learn how to deal with it and also how to eliminate violence in our language, it would make an impact for many people and less suffering. Yeah. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a big topic. I think when it comes to competence in many ways, it's our individual competence. So everyone can do self-reflection and everyone can train themselves to be better with postponing judgments and to have the courage to speak up and to listen to others. So that's one thing. There's another thing which I'm worried about. I tend to call it group stupidity. So I'm really worried that and annoyed that when people get together, pretty competent people, but still as a group, they can act stupidly. I mean, they can get to stupid decisions and make it very unsafe for each other. So the other way would be how to make the group more intelligent. So how to create team intelligence or group intelligence. And there you see that psychological safety is very important, like what Amy Edmondson is talking about. And I like to give the following example, what each and everyone can do tomorrow, today, this evening, is just imagine that there's two politicians and they go into a debate. And luckily, they don't know how to go into a dialogue, because we decided in politics we only do debate, which is an interesting assumption. But anyway, they go into a debate. And let's say that they debate on topic X, and they debate and they really truly debate. And within that, one of them says, whoa, you really got a point. Wow, you're right. That really hit home. I am changing my opinion. I'll come along with what you're proposing. Let's say that happens. People now will tell me, usually say, well, that will never happen. No. But just imagine, because the whole idea of a debate, and when you get different views, that if the conversation leads to it, you change your view because you want to get to the best decision ever. So let's say that one of the two politicians does that. Now, then my question is, again, to each and every one of us, what do we say on social media, in the newspapers, when we gossip with each other? How do we talk about that politician who changed his or her mind? We probably say something like that they're not very strong. You know, they go by with every, you know, they're too flexible and they're not, you cannot rely on them. So we create a negative norm on people who change their minds. So in that way, we collectively imprison people to stick with their opinion. And if they do change their opinion, we'll bash them. So that's where we all, well, create levels of group stupidity which are beyond imagination. So if we change that norm, and if we change our reaction to people who change their minds, we better say, oh, but that's great. Wow, how brave. How brave to really soak in the other information and to change your mind, and how brave to cooperate. So that's where we all have influence on the norm, because if we value as a society or an organization, if we value things like transparency, and if we truly value getting to best opinions and to flexible judgment, and if we truly put that in the core, then we need to act on it. And we need to say, but people who are transparent and who change their mind, they're beautiful. And that's where, again, we get to culture shaping. What we think is important, we need to put that into our behaviors. We create norms, and then we need to act on it. And we need to shape the world in a way that people with opposing views can truly interact. So we need to create meetings where they meet and we put the minds together. But again, that many times where I come in many organizations, there are meetings which are designed in a way that people cannot talk with each other. And we created norms that you should not change your mind because then you're not a tough leader. And that's bad. And the hopefulness to me and my optimism is that, well, you and I and everyone listening can change that. If you feel that's a stupid thing, well, don't do it. And address, if other people talk about it, say, don't do it. It's wonderful if someone changes his mind. And therefore, we can change the world in the direction we want. And each and everyone has power to do that.
So that's a powerful story to tell around leadership, right?
Yes. I hope so, because I think we trap leaders.
Yeah.
So we bash them. You see it also that if a group gets into trouble and doesn't know what to do, so we feel anxious, should we go left or right, or what shall we do? And then we tend to call for a charismatic leader saying, you should decide. And then the leader says, no, you try yourself. And then, no, we don't know. Please help us out. This is kind of a fear of freedom. Like, oh, we don't know. We get anxious and you decide what to do because we don't know. And then the leaders decide because they think that that's the best way to do. And then they give a decision. And then the group says, not that decision. I don't like that one. And they start gossiping around how bad the decision was. And if they were the leader, they would do it differently. So we have this dynamic that we do have the power to take decisions on many levels and ways. But because if you take the decision, it will define the world. And maybe you take the wrong decision. So you rather have someone else take the decision so they can take the blame. So you can blame them for it. So in that respect, we also trap leaders. So we trap leaders in making decisions which we actually could do ourselves. Then they take the decision, we say that's a wrong decision. And we trap leaders by, if they then do change their mind, saying, you're a bad leader now. So as groups, I think we can hold space way better than we do at this very moment. We're very simple things in a way.
Yeah. And I always come back to the point where this whole concept of giving people too much power is not really human, because it's not realistic that some person can make all the right decisions for just, I cannot be that competent, no matter how intelligent, how do we define intelligence anyway? But I mean, no matter how many personal genetic capabilities, whatever I bring with myself, I cannot be as informed as someone who is working on the topic. And that's why I am so interested in spontaneous hierarchies, because I understand the concept or the stability a hierarchy can give to a group and how that can really be super helpful. But then once there's too little flexibility, it gets unhuman, deeply unhuman, because it traps people. It takes away power from people who should have the power, who have children. I mean, they go home, they have children, they, you know, organize their whole life. But once they go to work, they're like, no, no. And other people are saying, no, no, people don't want to have that power. People are not able to do that leadership. Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what? I mean, they are voting, they have children, they live their life. Of course, they can make decisions, not about anything. But another person the same, yeah?
Yeah, I agree.
In theory, that's easy, but I think in practice, spontaneous hierarchies, I don't know how far we are. Is that something that you're looking into or you're working with?
Yeah, there's different forms of that, like self-organizing organizations. Well, I use a method which we call deep democracy a lot, which is developed in Southern Africa or South Africa by Myrna Lewis. The Lewis method, based on the work of Arnold Mindell. And it's a way in which groups learn how to make it safe for differences and to speak up, so to have a true dialogue. If that fails, then have a good debate to get back to the dialogue and to take decisions with the whole group. And where you do have different ranking systems in place, because that's just how it is. There's experts and there's non-experts and there's people with lots of experience and which are new to the job. But you take everyone seriously and you get to a deep democratic vote. So this is a method where not only on the interaction, it's inclusive and you look at all the different perspectives, but also in the decision-making process. So in the convergent phase of getting to a decision, you still listen to all voices, because many times what I see happening in organizations and societies is that sometimes we do have the true conversations, but when it comes to the decision, it's always the same, or it has to be the leader, or I don't know, someone. But the group can take a decision. They are capable of doing that. And then we have democracy. But there is a myth of democracy. That's what we say, that if there is a democratic vote, like the majority vote, let's say 80% wants it, that we kind of think that miraculously the 20% say, oh yeah, if you all want it, I want it too. That's not the case. They still want something else. So we need to do something about that. So with deep democracy, what we tend to do is look at the content and the deeper emotions, because they're all linked to each other, the deep levels of what's going on, plus deep in a sense that we ask the minority voice what they need to come along with the majority decision. And that's very powerful. And I know that people listening now say, yeah, but it won't work because, and they have all kind of examples why it won't work. And then I usually say, no, I know, because it's a different way of getting to a decision. And if it's very hard to get through those steps, then usually something else is going on. It's not about the topic what we need to decide on. There is a power struggle, or people don't like each other, or there is neglected emotions for years, or anything which we don't talk about. And we have to talk about that first before we can get to a true decision. But that's a decision-making process, which to me is very helpful in, what do you call it, the type of hierarchies which will just start up, because they still need to decide. So what I see in organizations where there is more shared power, or where there's people more self-organized, many times they have issues around interaction and decision, because in the end, they say, well, but who can decide on that? And that's because we're hierarchical beings. We are not birds flying in flocks. We're monkeys at a rock, and we want to know our position. But we can be flexible, but we need to work hard. It's like, democracy is not a given. Democracy is truly hard work. And if we don't know how to dialogue, democracies die. If we don't know how to listen to different voices and to create new ways of doing things together, democracies die. And then we look at someone giving us a dictate, and that's easy. And that's called a dictator. But if we don't want that, it's hard work. It's really making sure that we can have the dialogue and looking at the different views, and find ways to get decisions. And sometimes someone can decide for us because they have more knowledge, and it's fine, as long as we can always challenge that.
It's I love the topic. I love what you do, really.
Thank you.
But we're coming to an end. Maybe just because I was so curious about the theater work that you were doing and then the connection to development and learning. Do you have some insights on that?
Yeah. The first thing what comes to mind when it comes to using theater is there's two things. If you want to change something, so if you want to go through transformation, most people know that that will need some experiments. So we need to experiment with stuff because you cannot think of something completely new and then implement it and it will go right the first day. It doesn't work like that. So we need to in the transition phase, go through chaos, discomfort, not knowing, trying, failing, getting up again. And that's a phase where we need to be playful. Because only in playfulness you can find new stuff. So transition is what anthropologists call liminality. So the phase in betwixt and between. And that's a phase where the old norms and the things, how things were organized, they don't count anymore. We don't know where the new stuff will be. So we're in this in between. And in between, we need play. We need to try out. We need to create new language. We need to figure out if we need different roles and responsibilities. So therefore, what you see in cultures across the globe is that we use rituals to mark the different phases that the ritual said, okay, this is how it used to be. Now we go into this in-between phase and then we get a ritual again. And rituals, they're always linked with music and theater and drama and storytelling and, you know, lighting candles, blowing out candles, breaking stuff. It's like what we do because we are emotional, narrative, storytelling beings. And the thing is that somehow we forget that we are like that when we enter an office building, because it's not a playful situation. You get your KPIs and you hit your targets and value for money and get a suit and don't play. And therefore, but we all want innovation and we strive for that and we get a project plan with milestones to get to innovation. But we need to create play full time in between. And that's where it comes to me, like things like theater, because we are emotional beings. So that's one, is really understanding that if you want to go through transformation, innovation, allow yourself to be playful and really try things out and be silly. Walk silly through the hallways and find new, because your brain needs to find new connections. And you can't find new connections if you sit in the same suit at the same desk all the time, having the same behavior. You need to break out of that. So that's one. And the other one is that when it comes to learning, like I'm in the business also of giving talks on stage. And I get to the point that companies and organizers ask me for the five takeaways, the best bullet points ever, which we can implement tomorrow. I have a problem with that. I have a problem with that because there are no such things as the five golden bullet points for everyone in the world. You have to think yourself. That's what you paid for as a leader, to think and rethink and to see what it takes in your company. And If we look at talks, if I only go through the bullet points and I give you a graph, it sounds really great in that moment. But the chances you remember it 2 days later are very small. The chances you remember them. So the only way you can remember them, if there is a narrative to it, if there's a story to it, because you remember the story and that leads back to the bullet point. If there's a song related to it, if there's music, if you laughed or cried. So we are emotional beings, and the things we remember and the things we deal with is when it really touches us. And spreadsheets and bullet points don't have the power to move us to tears. Well, sometimes they do, but you know what I mean? So also there, I think theater and the use of music and the use of stories and light and the whole stage setting is important to bring messages across. So also when it comes to conferences, be aware that it helps if you use all the things from theater into your talks, because people will remember better and maybe not the words and maybe not the exact bullet points or the graph, but they remember the story. And if they want to have know the figures, they look it up, you know, provide it, put it on a website, but make sure that at that moment you move people to a certain direction or feel or story.
Ach ja. So we are coming to an end. If people would like to look up your work, how can they find you?
They can always go to my website, jitskakramer.com. Mm-hmm. It's in English. On Instagram, I'll share my story. So if you go to Jitska Kramer at Instagram, I'll share what I find, my learnings during the research period, because people can still connect with me the coming months. And I do take on some keynotes, but I'm very, very picky on them because I want to take time for mental space. So if they have like a really great proposal, I will look into it. So, and on LinkedIn, of course, you can find me on LinkedIn. So those are the places where you can find me and also connect with me.
I have two more final questions. The people who listen are super interested in books. Do you have any books? I know it's a hard question. So, and maybe any books that spontaneously come to mind, or some books that you've given to people that you like to recommend?
Well, a really tough one, a really good one, is called The Dawn of Everything, which is by David Graeber and David Wengrow. But it's a big one, but it is really re-describing our history. It's an anthropologist, David Graeber. He unfortunately died, written together with another David, who is an archaeologist. And it's really linking back to what you say. Are we impacted by the story we lived and how we make interpretations of history? And they rewrite it. They just say, well, we got it wrong. So The Dawn of Everything is really restating our history and giving an alternative, which is also based on extensive research. It's a very thick book. But it's really nice for the ones who really want to dig into something. Yeah, maybe there's one I still need to read. I'm so my to-do list. Doing Good Better, Effective Altruism by William Magaskill. I still have to read it, but it's truly about, as a corporate, you can, you know, ruin the world and then do charity. Or you cannot ruin the world and integrate doing good into the way you operate. And this book is a guide on how to truly make a difference and to truly change our ways, doing less harmful stuff. But again, I still need to read it.
Thank you. And are there maybe any people or topics that inspire you at the moment a lot? Is there something? Because sometimes I'm into some topics that are not particularly related to what I'm working on, but just in general.
Yeah, there is a topic. Well, it's a topic. I'm also in the research, not literally a person, but I want to know more about the witch hunt we did in this part of the world. And to me, that's part of the research project I'll be doing, is that trying to understand how we got to the idea that it was good to burn 50 to 60,000 witches, which 3/4 was women, and what impact that has on our view of strong women, what impact it has on our view of our relation to nature in this part of the world. Because I am intrigued that we kind of find it cool to look at ayahuasca in the Amazon, and that we like the spiritual paths of shamans all over the world. But if we think about Western Europe, our traditional indigenous shamanistic views, we make fun of that. We call them tree huggers. Well, it's interesting. So I think but that's a hunch, and I'll dive into that. I think that if we put life more at the center of our system, so we value life, it's beyond human centered. We had like production in the center for a long time, economic growth, and we started to believe in people more. And let's say, and I think so, well, that it will move into that we put life-centered value systems in place, then things will really start to shift, because it will have a huge impact, because then the trees will have a voice. And it's very hard to kill the animals in the way we do now if we put life at the center of stuff. So what is the impact? And to me, it needs to that we need to rebalance our connection with Earth, because we lost that. And that's what we can learn from different indigenous cultures in the world. So one of the topics I'm interested in is our relationship with the indigenous storylines in this part of the world. And they moved into the categories of funny, of stupid, of strange, of dangerous. I'm just intrigued why and how we can change that. Because I think, to me, there is a key to some other issues, but maybe not. You can ask me in a couple of months.
Sounds great. I feel blessed to have been able to talk to you, and all the best for you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Ich hoffe sehr, dass du aus diesem Gespräch ordentlich etwas mitnehmen konntest. Du findest in den Shownotes zu dieser Folge auf female-leadership-academy.de auch nochmal die Buchempfehlung und auch nochmal eine Übersicht des Gesprächs und Input von Jitzke. Und ich gehe auf jeden Fall ganz inspiriert aus dieser Unterhaltung und danke dir, dass du hier zugehört hast. Wenn dir der Podcast gefällt, freue ich mich natürlich riesig über eine 5-Sterne-Bewertung. Es tut dem Podcast sehr gut, damit er gefunden wird. Natürlich auch, wenn er weiterempfohlen wird. Und ich weiß, dass ganz viele Menschen ihn hier weiterempfehlen. Insofern vielen herzlichen Dank für deine Unterstützung. Und jetzt erstmal eine richtig schöne Woche. Und dann freue ich mich, wenn wir uns hier nächste Woche wieder hören. Bis dahin und alles Liebe, deine Vera.